gallery were allowed to join us. After all, our seats cost so much more than theirs, but now the war has virtually started, we're all in it together, and we don't mind. Don't you think it feels much more friendly now we're all sitting together?" All the moving and shuffling about had stopped, and everyone was waiting for the curtain to rise.
"I suppose it does," Amy agreed.
There was a warmer atmosphere, but it was spoilt, rather, by the woman's talk of war. There were more signs of war the next day, a gun battery in Hyde Park, for instance. Notices in the big shops telling customers where to shelter if the air raid siren sounded. Sandbags outside important buildings, and quite a few people already self-consciously carrying their gas masks in boxes over their shoulders. One woman had crocheted a pretty cover for hers, with raised flowers on all six sides. They wandered along Oxford Street and had coffee in Selfridges. Outside, Barney hailed a taxi that took them to Harrods. "The most famous shop in England," he said, "and probably the most expensive." Amy nearly fainted when she saw the price of the clothes. Even Barney, who was incredibly generous, didn't offer to buy her anything, although he got a lovely canteen of cutlery in a black leather case with velvet lining as a present for Charlie and Marion.
"Even Marion is bound to like that," Amy said.
"It just might bring a smile to her miserable face."
"And what can I do to bring a smile to your face, Amy?" Barney whispered in her ear.
Amy whispered something back, and he said,
"Your wish is my command, Mrs. Patterson."
With that, he hailed a taxi, and they returned to the hotel, and didn't emerge until it was almost tea time. Next morning, Thursday, when they came down to breakfast, a number of guests had gathered in the lounge and were listening to the wireless. Barney said he thought they should catch up on the latest news, but Amy said she wasn't interested in the news, not while she was in London.
"I'll order breakfast," she said. "What do you want?"
"Everything," Barney said, "and tell them I like my toast well done." He had the appetite of a horse. Minutes later, the pot of tea she'd asked for had arrived, but there was no sign of Barney. A couple in their 60s were seated at the next table. The woman said,
"I really think we should go home today, darling, so we can help Sally get the children ready to go to Aunt Alice's. She'll have a job seeing to the five of them on her own."
"You're right, Flora. After we've finished eating, we'll pack and catch the first train out of Waterloo. It might be hell on earth tomorrow."
Barney came back.
He didn't say anything, just looked grim. Amy poured him tea.
"What's happening tomorrow?" she asked.
"The man on the next table said it might be hell on earth, but I think he was talking about the trains."
"Do you really want to know?"
Amy sighed.
"Yes." She couldn't very well ignore the war any longer. It was childish to pretend the threat didn't exist.
"The government has ordered the evacuation of children to begin in the morning." Barney unfolded his linen napkin and spread it on his knee. "It might not be a bad idea to set off then rather than wait until tea time. The roads could be very busy."
"It hasn't been much of a honeymoon, has it, Amy?" he said ruefully.
"Tell you what," his brown eyes brightened, "one of these days we'll come back to London for a whole week. Or we could even go to Paris. We'll have a proper honeymoon, you'll see."
They'd planned to spend the day sightseeing, but Amy had lost interest.
"We can do it another time. I'd sooner just walk around the shops than look at Buckingham Palace and the Houses of Parliament," she said when they came out of the hotel.
"I'd like to buy a present for Mam and our Jackie and Biddy and your Harry and Kathy."
She realised it was ages since she'd seen the friend she'd used to see every day of the week.
"I'll get her something really nice."
Barney loved shopping almost as much as she did, and he readily agreed. He said he'd quite like a new suit for Saturday's wedding. "I fancy pale grey with a white stripe. Charlie isn't wearing morning dress, is he?"
"Good heavens, no," she laughed.
"He's bought a new suit too. It's plain dark blue."
"Let's get your stuff first."
He tucked her arm inside his. "Oh, and we must get you a present, darling. A souvenir of London. How about an engagement ring?
I never got round to buying you one."
"I'm sorry, but our honeymoon is turning into a bit of a washout."
"It's not. I've loved every minute. I'm really glad we came, and I'd love an engagement ring."
They stopped in Park Lane for a long, lingering, tender kiss. They made a striking couple. Barney so tall and elegant in his brown summer suit. and Amy as pretty as a picture in emerald green. Passers-by treated them to an amused smile or a disagreeable look, depending upon their mood. A few people wondered if they'd seen them before in a Hollywood film. 4 hours later, they had lunch in John Lewis's restaurant on the top floor. Amy examined her ring, a solitary diamond on the third finger of her left hand. She twisted her hand this way and that, admiring the way the facets of the jewel twinkled. Satisfied, she turned her attention to the thing she had bought, a snakeskin handbag for Mam, 2 plain leather handbags for her sisters, and a really pretty ivory lace blouse for Kathy, which was dressy enough to go dancing in, but plain enough for work. "What shall we get you, Harry?" she asked. She genuinely liked her brother-in-law. They met in town for dinner every Sunday night. After much discussion, they decided to get him a propelling pencil in its own little black box. It had a rubber concealed inside the screw top and a supply of spare leads. Amy insisted they catch a red bus back to the hotel to deposit their parcels. "I've never been on a bus before. At home we go everywhere on the tram." Barney bought the Evening Standard so they could look through the pictures and decide what to see that night, their last in London.
"The fleet's been mobilised, mate,"
the news vendor said. He was a heavily freckled young man, barely 5 feet tall.
"It ain't in the papers yet. Someone just told me."
Amy's feet were aching. When they got to their room, she decided to have a bath while Barney read the paper. She emptied the little jar of complimentary bath salts into the steaming water, climbed in, and immediately fell asleep. When she woke, she wrapped herself in a giant white towel and found Barney had fallen asleep on the bed. He had removed his jacket and waistcoat and loosened the collar of his shirt. He lay on his side, curled up like a baby, one hand spread on the pillow. Amy lay beside him. She laced her fingers through his. But he didn't wake, just sighed.
"Oh, Barney," she whispered. She loved him so much that it hurt, really hurt, making her throat ache and her heart. There really was something called heartache.
He opened one eye, the other was hidden in the pillow, reached for the towel and dragged it off. They made love. It wasn't the least bit gentle, but fiercely passionate and full of bitter anger at what was going to happen tomorrow, or the next day, or the day after that. The world was about to turn upside down and inside out, not just for them, but for everyone in the country, and possibly the entire world.
"I don't feel like going to the pictures," Amy said later,
when Barney began to read out the films showing in London that night. Not even Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with James Stewart, her favourite actor, appealed.
"I wouldn't be able to concentrate. Let's go somewhere where we can talk."
"We can talk while we walk," Barney said with a grin.
They strolled along Park Lane until they reached Piccadilly, arms linked. At Piccadilly Circus, they watched the brightly coloured lights flash on and off. Then they sat on the crowded steps of Eros and sang "Keep the Home Fires Burning" and "It's a Long Way to Tipperary" with an impromptu choir. Buses, cars and taxis circled slowly around them, sounding their horns, as if that would somehow make the traffic go faster. There were quite a few people in uniform, nearly all young. Very soon Barney would have a uniform, possibly as early as next week. He'd vowed that if his call-up papers hadn't arrived by the time they got home, he'd call in at the recruitment office and volunteer. Amy clung to his arm. She wasn't being the least bit brave about things. All she wanted to do was cry. Next morning, after an early breakfast, Amy and Barney stood outside the hotel with their luggage while they waited for the car to be brought. "We'll come back one day," Barney promised, kissing her nose when she got into the Morris beside him. They'd only been going a matter of minutes when they realised they should have left sooner. The traffic was at an almost complete standstill. It took nearly half an hour, edging forward inches at a time, to reach the end of Park Lane. It would appear everyone was anxious to get away from London before the war officially began. Cars were piled high with luggage. The children in the car in front knelt on the back seat and made incredible faces at them. But Amy, who would normally have enjoyed making faces back, just didn't have the heart. It took almost 3 hours to reach the outskirts of the city, where the traffic wasn't quite so heavy. But it was still heavy enough, as the cars were joined by coaches full of children,
being evacuated to the countryside.
We should have gone home yesterday, Barney said for the fifth or sixth time.
Where are we?
Amy asked after about an hour.
I've no idea, he looked moided. I reckon some of the road signs have been removed.
Soon afterwards they passed a train station and Amy asked him to stop because she badly needed a lavatory, having drunk far too much tea that morning. Barney must have drunk too much too. He emerged from the station at the same time as she did.
It's worse on the trains than on the roads, he said, when they set off again. Some chap just told me. Everyone's jammed together like sardines. At least we've got somewhere to sit.
An hour later they found themselves approaching Oxford, and Barney suggested they stop and have a drink and something to eat. There's a pub not far ahead. It should be open by now. Amy was longing for a break. It was a relief to turn off the busy road and stop outside the Malted Loaf, which just opened for business. They took their drinks and a plate of ham sandwiches into the sunny garden and sat on a bench beside a rough wooden table, as far away from the sound of traffic as it was possible to be. They were the only customers. Close by, a bee buzzed noisily, and a man could be seen through a hawthorn hedge, cutting grass with a scythe. It was such a peaceful scene that it was hard to believe the country was in such a state of panic. Another couple came into the garden. The man waved and shouted, "Have you heard? Hitler's invaded Poland. Warsaw has been bombed. To all intents and purposes, this country is at war with Germany." Khaki-painted lorries had joined the traffic, some packed with troops, adding to the chaos. There were occasions when everything ground to a halt and took ages to get started again because a vehicle had broken down ahead. Policemen on bikes pedalled through the lines of cars, lorries and coaches, trying to sort out the mess. Traffic was diverted down pretty minor roads lined with trees, barely wide enough for two vehicles to pass. At one point a crowd of children picnicked on the grass verge, while steam spurted from the bonnet of their coach. It was past tea time, and some families had driven their vehicles into fields and erected tents, presumably to spend the night there.
"That's what we could do with," Barney muttered. "A tent. I can't see us getting to Liverpool tonight. We're only about halfway there. When we get to Coventry, perhaps we should look for a hotel and stay till morning."
"But what about Charlie's wedding?" Amy cried.
"I'd forgotten about it."
He wiped his white, strained face on the sleeve of his shirt and sighed with exhaustion. Amy's shoulders were aching badly. She would have loved to stay the night in a hotel, but couldn't possibly miss her only brother's wedding. Mam would be dead upset, and Marion would never forgive her. She suggested that when they got to Coventry, they stopped for a few hours.
"Let's have a proper meal," she said more cheerfully than she felt. "We can have a little rest afterwards. Surely the roads won't be all that busy when it's dark. Another few hours should do it."
She couldn't wait to get to their flat. The fish and chip restaurant on the fringes of Coventry was a rough and ready place, but the food was delicious. The chips crisp outside and soft inside, the fish white and flaky, and the batter as light as air. They washed it down with mugs of milky tea. Barney looked his old self again by the time they'd finished. Outside they walked up and down for a few minutes to stretch their legs. Amy felt as if her knees were about to buckle. The traffic had lessened considerably while they'd been eating, and it was rapidly growing dark. So dark that there was something unnatural, almost ghostly about it. Amy noticed that there wasn't a light to be seen in any building, and not even the street lamps had been turned on. The traffic crawled along, as headlamps were covered with black paper, leaving just a narrow slit for the light to shine through. She pointed this out to Barney, who put his hands to his face and groaned. "Oh, shit!"
"Barney!"
She'd never known him swear before.
"Sorry, darling, but the blackout started. I'd forgotten it was today. I should have made shields for the lights."
"You mean we can't have the headlamps on properly?"
They'd never be able to see where they were going. Even now, in a road full of shops and houses, the night was getting blacker and blacker. It was hard to make out the outlines of the buildings against the dark sky. Once they reached the countryside, it would be impossible.
"We'll find a hotel and stay the night," she said flatly. "If we start off really early in the morning, we might manage to get to the wedding on time. If we don't, it's just too bad." Funny sort of families her children were marrying into,
Moira thought, as she sat in the taxi feeling a bit like the Queen of England. It was the first taxi ride of her life. Amy had been married for almost 3 months, and there'd been no suggestion of meeting Barney's mum and dad. Moira didn't like to push, but thought it would be nice if they were all friends together. They could ask each other round at Christmas, even if it was only for a drink, and celebrate their children's birthdays together. She hoped Amy wasn't ashamed of her mum. Today had been Charlie's wedding, and what a lovely day it was for it too. Brilliantly sunny, and the temperature perfect. She'd gone to the Holy Cross Church in Scotland Road with Jackie and Biddy, expecting to meet at least a few members of Marion's family. Her parents were dead, but surely she'd have a sister or other relatives. But the only guests were Charlie's family and a handful of people Marion worked with at the English Electric. Moira would have liked to have invited both her sisters from Ireland to the wedding, and some of Joe's relatives she still saw. Her friend Nellie Tyler would have loved to come, and it would have been a friendly gesture to ask Kathy Burns. She was a lovely girl, and Amy had badly let her down. She'd even envisaged Jackie and Biddy being bridesmaids, an expense she wouldn't have minded. But there'd been no suggestion of that, or of inviting more than Charlie's immediate family. In the church, while worrying that the blue costume she got from Paddy's Market was too obviously second-hand, and her blue hat was showing its age, despite having been freshened up with a yard of cream net, it gradually dawned on her that Amy and Barney weren't coming, and she began to worry about them as well, not to mention the war that she'd been worried about for months. Her daughter and lovely new son-in-law hadn't been seen for a few days, but that wasn't unusual. Surely they hadn't forgotten today was the day that Charlie was getting married. The wedding was turning into a nightmare. The nuptial mass over, one of the friends took half a dozen photos and everyone made their way to a restaurant in Scotty Road, where a cold buffet awaited them in an upstairs room. Moira ate a few slices of tinned ham, drank a mouthful of wine, and informed the bride and groom that she was leaving. "I'm dead worried about our Amy," she said in a rush. "Her and Barney might have had an accident in the car or something. I'll pop round to the flat and see if they're all right." Pop round was a bit of an understatement, as the flat was miles away on the other side of Liverpool. Charlie squeezed her hand. "To tell the truth, ma'am, I'm a bit worried myself. I know Amy was looking forward to the wedding. But there's a phone box outside. Why don't you telephone? I'll do it for you if you like." "I haven't got the number, love." She felt close to tears. "Our Amy wrote it down on a piece of paper and put it behind the clock on the mantelpiece. I never thought to put it in me bag." "Give your mum half a crown, Charlie, so she can get a taxi," Marion said kindly. So kindly that Moira wondered if she'd badly misjudged the woman who was now her daughter-in-law. Now here she was, stepping out of the black cab outside Amy's grand house by Newsham Park. She'd been there before, quite a few times, but had never come unannounced. She gave the doorbell four rings to indicate it was the tenants at the top she'd come to see. Almost immediately, Captain Kirby Green, who lived on the ground floor, opened the door. He bowed courteously.
"Good afternoon, Mrs. Curran. I saw you from the window. I thought I would let you in. Save your daughter having to come all the way down."
Thank you, Mr. Captain," Moira stammered,
amazed that he'd recognised her when they'd only met the once, and then only for the time it took for Amy to introduce them. She was halfway upstairs when he said gruffly,
"Ahem,"
and she turned.
"I hope you don't mind my saying, Mrs. Curran," he said shyly, "but you look especially charming today."
"Of course I don't mind, Captain," she flushed with pleasure.
He wasn't bad-looking for a man of his age, a good 60, she reckoned. His hair was a lovely silver, and there was plenty of it, though his obviously false teeth were too big for his mouth.
"Is that you, ma'am?"
Amy had come out onto the landing two floors up.
"Yes, love, I'm just coming."
She waved hurrah to the captain and continued upstairs, aware his eyes were following her until she disappeared.
"Oh, ma'am, I know we've missed our Charlie's wedding," Amy cried when Moira arrived. "I'm dead sorry. I was really looking forward to it."
She looked as if she'd been dragged through a hedge backwards and was still wearing her dressing gown. Her small white feet were bare.
You wouldn't believe the day we had yesterday trying to get home from London. In the end, we had to give up altogether when we realised the blackout had started. So we stayed at some hotel. Well, it was more a bed and breakfast place, and the woman wouldn't give us a hot drink before we went to bed. We offered to pay, but she said it was against the rules. Neither of us slept a wink all night long. She was babbling now, the words tripping over each other as she tried to get them out. We left them and it was light. Then poor Barney felt really ill and we had to keep stopping so he could be sick at the side of the road. It must have been something yet.
Where is he, love? Moira put her arm around her daughter's shoulders and they went into the flat.
In bed, fast asleep. I wanted to get the doctor, but he wouldn't let me.
Amy paused for an anguished breath.
And oh, ma'am, you'll never guess. His call-up papers arrived while we were away. They want him in the army. He was supposed to report somewhere today. He said he'll telephone when he feels better.
Can I have a peep at him? Amy nodded and Moira opened the bedroom door a crack. All she could see was the top of Barney's head. The rest of him was buried beneath an untidy heap of bedclothes. His breathing sounded perfectly steady. She quietly closed the door. He's probably just tired now, Amy. When he wakes up, just give him plenty of water or weak tea. You can make him a bowl of bread and milk if he feels hungry. Now, if you don't mind, love, I'm longing for a cuppa. I'll make it. You sit down and rest a minute. Her mother's presence must have calmed her. Amy sat on the leather settee facing the window.
It's a lovely day, she said, as if she'd only just noticed the way the sun shone on the slate roofs of the houses across the park, making them glisten like sheets of glass. How did the wedding go? She asked when Moira came in with two cups of tea.
All right, Moira shrugged. There was hardly anyone there, only about a dozen of us altogether. Charlie and your sisters were really worried when you two didn't turn up.
Marion hadn't asked any relatives, just friends from work.
Her dress wasn't up to much, she said in retrospect. To be frank, it looked as if it had cost about 19 and 11 pence in Blackler's bargain basement.
And she didn't carry a bouquet, just a prayer book.
As for the reception, it was pathetic. I mean, tinned ham at a wedding.
And they're not going on honeymoon, but staying in the new house.
It was a bit late to feel indignant, but the whole thing had clearly been done on the cheap. She sniffed, feeling hard done by.
I haven't been introduced to any of Marion's relatives. Or Barney's come to that. I'm beginning to think you and Aunt Charlie are ashamed of your mum.
Amy uttered a very unladylike snort.
Don't be daft, ma'am. It's more likely to be the other way round, and Marion's ashamed of letting her family meet you. You look really smart in that costume. As for Barney's, ma'am, I haven't met her either. She's an Irish Protestant and can't stand Catholics.
Dear God in heaven, Amy, Moira muttered, making the sign of the cross. What sort of crowd have you married into?
I married Barney, ma'am, not his family.
I suppose so, Moira conceded. She was feeling a bit better about herself. It wasn't only what Amy had said, but the way Captain Kirby Green had looked at her. And although the wedding had been done on the cheap, it was due to Marion that she'd come all this way in a taxi. She felt even better when Amy produced the presents she had bought in London and gave her a snakeskin handbag.
A real snake?
Moira stroked the pitted grey and black leather and hoped the snake had died a peaceful death.
Well, they wouldn't call it snakeskin if it didn't come from a real snake, ma'am.
Amy managed a wan smile.
We got our Jackie and Biddy handbags too, and a lovely canteen of cutlery for Charlie and Marion.
It's a pity I couldn't have got everything to you before the wedding.
Never mind, Amy. Better late than never. I'll take all this stuff back with me in a taxi.
The journey had only cost 9 pence, and she'd given the driver a penny tip, so there was enough left out of the half crown to take her back to Bootle.
In that case, you can take this blouse I got for Cathy as well.
Amy waved a pretty ivory lace blouse.
I'd sooner not. It'd be better if you gave that to Cathy yourself.
Since her daughter had married Barney Patterson, her brains had turned to feathers, and she seemed to have forgotten Cathy's existence. Barney was just as bad. Moira couldn't think of anything dafter than skipping off to London when they both knew the war was likely to start any time soon. At tea time, Barney got up, saying he felt a bit better. He had a bath but refused bread and milk when it was offered, pretending to gag, and saying it could well make him sick again.
Anyway, before I do anything else, I want to sort out the matter of my call-up, he added.
There won't be anyone there, said Amy. It's Saturday afternoon.
My darling girl, there's almost a war on. I can assure you the phone will be manned at the other end.
He was right. When he dialed the number, it was answered immediately.
Amy went into the tiny kitchen and tried not to listen as he arranged to report to somewhere near Chester at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning.
It means I'll have to leave on Monday, he said when he'd finished.
Will you go in the car?
She asked, surprised that she was able to pose a perfectly sane and sensible question.
No, it would be best if I went by train. I'll leave the car where it is, outside in the road.
Harry will see to it if it has to be laid up, darling. It depends on how long this damned war lasts.
He took her in his arms, his face sober.
How will I live without you, eh?
I wish I knew, Amy said with a sob, because then I might know how I will live without you.
They decided not to go out to dinner and had an early night instead. On Sunday, Amy went to Mass for the first time since she'd married Barney. Mam would have a fit if she knew she'd been missing Mass for months. And he went to tell his family that he was leaving the following day.
I might be sent back, he said before leaving for Calderstone's. They might not need me yet, or I might not pass the medical.
But both he and Amy knew he would be needed straight away. And there wasn't a chance in a million he would fail the medical, a fine, healthy young man like him. In church, she prayed a miracle would happen, and the war would be avoided. It was still possible. But when she arrived home, Captain Kirby Green came out of his room and told her the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, had just been on the wireless and announced that war had been declared on Germany.
And about time, too, he said indignantly. We should have done something about that Hitler chappy long before now. A bloody good hiding might bring him to his senses.
He bowed majestically. I hope you will excuse my French, Mrs. Patterson.
Of course, Captain, she said quietly.
She ran upstairs, rushed into the flat, and burst into tears. Barney came home looking very serious. His mother had taken the news badly.
She hasn't been feeling well lately.
Poor thing, Amy said sympathetically. Would it help if I went to see her?
No, it would only make her feel even worse.
He'd bought a packet of 20 senior service while he was out, although he only smoked occasionally. Amy had tried but hated it. Now he smoked incessantly while they packed the suitcase, trying to think of every single thing he was likely to need, as if once he had closed the door of the flat behind him, he would never again have the opportunity to buy razors or hankies or a comb. They didn't make love that night, just curled up in bed together. Barney lay on his side with Amy tucked against him, held there by the weight of his arm on her waist. At some time during the night, he removed his arm, kissed her, and climbed out of bed. Amy came to for a moment, gave a little cry, and immediately went back to sleep. Next morning when she woke up, the suitcase had gone, and so had Barney. He left a note saying he just couldn't bear the idea of saying goodbye. I love you too much, my darling. I'm taking the coward's way out. I'm sure you'll soon realise this is the simplest way for us both. He was right. The worst of it, the parting, was over. Now she was left with only half a life, and she had no alternative but to get on with it, like all the other women in the country whose men were being called upon to fight.
Chapter 5. April to May 1971. Pearl.
After we've finished our tea, I'd like us to discuss having the hall, stairs and landing decorated, Marion announced on Monday. So don't leave the table, either of you.
No, miss, Charles winked at me.
Shall I take the minutes? He asked with mock seriousness. And may I suggest that Pearl chairs the meeting?
This isn't a joke, Charles, Marion chided. The three of us live in this house together, and it's only right and proper that we come to a decision regarding what is to be done that will suit us all. It's called democracy, she finished primly.
Charles could hardly contain his amusement.
At least once a year, Marion would call what he referred to a board meeting to discuss the decoration she had planned. Her mind was already made up, but Charles and I were allowed to put forward suggestions, which would then be so politely and tactfully rejected that we weren't aware it was happening and could end up thinking we'd had our own way. At least that's what used to happen
but these days we were wise to Marion's manipulative ways and regarded the whole procedure as an entertaining charade. The discussion always took place while we were seated at the table, not in armchairs. Perhaps Marion thought this added gravitas to the occasion. Tonight, as soon as the meal was over, she produced a shorthand notebook and a pencil and announced she was open to suggestions.
"Brown and cream," Charles said immediately. "Brown at the bottom and cream at the top, with a narrow border in between."
"And what colour would the border be?" Marion inquired.
"Why, a mixture of brown and cream, dear."
Marion gave him a sharp look, but his face was completely straight.
"What about you, Pearl?"
"I'd quite like brown and cream too."
Marion made notes. "I quite like that colour combination. Would either of you mind if we got a pinkish cream and a reddish brown?"
"No," Charles and I said together. It appeared the matter was going to take less time than usual.
"I wonder," Marion said thoughtfully, "what you think of the idea of having two borders, a wide one between the colours and a narrow one adjacent to the ceiling. We could get them in cream and brown, as Charles suggested."
"Or pinkish cream and reddish brown. That would look even better, dear."
Marion frowned.
"Are you making fun of me, Charles Curran?"
"As if I would, dear."
The telephone rang and Marion went to answer it. Charles said,
"She knows I'm making fun, and she knows that I know that she knows I'm making fun, but neither of us minds."
"Am I in the way?" I asked,
taking even myself by surprise, but it had suddenly occurred to me that my aunt and uncle might have even more fun if they had the house to themselves. Charles's jaw dropped.
"What a silly question, Pearl. Of course you're not in the way. You've blessed our lives. I don't know what Marion and I would have done without you."
"Did you want children of your own?"
"Of course we did, but it just didn't happen."
Charles shrugged. "But even if we'd had children, we would still have wanted you." He smiled at me tenderly.
"You were a real little charmer, and you still are, though not so little now.
We both loved you long before the accident." He always referred to my father's death as the accident. He squeezed my hand.
"What's brought this on, hey?"
"I was wondering if I'd outstayed my welcome," I said in a small voice. "I'm 25. By now most women are married. You and Marion could be having a better time without me."
"That's ridiculous," Charles said warmly. "Most people never want their children to leave, and that's how we think of you as ours.
What we would like more than anything is for you to stay and look after Marion and me in our old age. Give us our medicine and wipe our chins."
I laughed, feeling relieved.
"At the rate I'm going, I probably will.
If it comes to the stage where we can't wipe our own bottoms, then you must put us in a home."
Marion came in.
"That was Harry Patterson on the phone. He's invited us to dinner on Wednesday. He wanted to know if we all liked Chinese food, and I said we did. It seems there's a new restaurant in Bold Street. Is everyone happy with that? I can always ring him back if you have other plans."
"It suits me fine," Charles said.
"Me too."
Trish was getting married next week. Once she'd gone, I was most unlikely to have other plans, apart from my parents' evenings and various school events. It really was time I seriously considered what to do with the rest of my life. Otherwise, I would end up looking after Charles and Marion in their old age, though I balked at the idea of having to wipe their bottoms. Harry Patterson had never married. I visualised him having met a girl during the war who had been killed or had married someone else. Like his brother, Barney, Harry had joined the army and been sent to France. The brothers had belonged to different regiments, and Harry had never become an officer. But they had actually met on the road to Dunkirk when they'd passed each other. Harry on his way towards the boats that were taking the fleeing troops back to England, and my father returning to hold the enemy at bay, while his comrades, including his brother, got away on one of the flotilla of boats that had come to rescue them.
"At the time, I thought I'd never see your dad again," Harry told me when I was about 14, and suddenly found myself with loads of unanswered questions.
"But you did, didn't you?"
I asked anxiously, as if Harry could change history by denying it. I tried to imagine my youthful father bravely pushing his way back through the departing troops. Did he feel lonely all on his own? It was years later before it struck me that he hadn't fought a lone battle, that he would have other soldiers with him.
Of course, your dad came back safe and sound, but it was a long time after me, not until the war was over.
And you were with him when you met my mum?
Yes, Pearl, we met your mum on Southport Pier, and Aunt Cathy.
Do you call her Aunt Cathy?
Auntie Cathy.
Cathy, Miss Burns, nowadays I didn't know what to call her, had always come to my birthday parties along with Grandma Curran, who was my mother's mother. She was really sweet and one of the few people in the world that Marian liked. My other grandma only sent a card and a postal order. Marian said she was an evil old hag. I think it was the only thing on which Marian and my mother agreed. Both grandmas had died in 1960, within a few months of each other, leaving me with a grandpa I only saw a few times a year, two uncles and an aunt. I didn't count the two aunts I could hardly remember, Jackie and Biddy, who'd gone to Canada after my mother's trial, or the five Canadian cousins I'd never even seen. I would have loved to have had more relatives of my own age, but the ones I had were all that God had intended, and I would just have to put up with it. Uncle Harry was already in the restaurant when we arrived. He was 54, a distinguished-looking man with brown eyes and dark hair sprinkled with grey. He worked for the medical instrument company that belonged to his father, Leo Patterson.
"Hello there."
He seemed delighted to see us, kissing Marian and me and shaking hands with Charles. He wore a charcoal grey suit with the very palest of blue shirts and a navy blue tie with a gold crest. Marian said his ties were pure silk and his suits hand-tailored, though I was unable to tell.
"You're all looking very fit," he said.
"I could say the same of you, Harry," Charles said jovially. The two men got on well together. "Have you just had a holiday?"
"A fortnight in Morocco,"
Harry replied. His face was brown from the sun.
"Pa's making plans to go to Paris soon. Says he feels like a break. He won't leave the company in anyone else's hands but mine."
This was said with childish pride.
"It's not like Leo to take a holiday. How old is he now?"
"An extremely healthy 75. He and my mother were barely out of their teens when they got married. I can't help but wonder what he intends getting up to in Paris," he said with an amused twinkle. "By the way, has anyone heard from Amy?"
"Not a word," Charles replied. "We have no idea where she is."
There followed a discussion as to where my mother could be and who had collected her from prison, to which neither Marian nor I contributed a word.
"I had a reporter call me the other day,"
Harry said self-importantly. I suspected he had a gigantic inferiority complex, what with a hugely successful father and a brother who'd been superior to him in every possible way, or so I'd been given to understand.
"I professed total ignorance as to Amy's whereabouts, which is true, and told him that, so far as I knew, all her relatives lived abroad. I knew not where."
The waiter came with the menus, and there was silence for a few minutes while we chose the food. I wasn't an adventurous eater. I ordered curried prawns and rice, while the others ordered a whole range of exotic dishes to share. 15 minutes later, the table was groaning with food. On top of my own meal, I was encouraged to try a bit of this or a slice of that, until I began to feel sick. They probably didn't realise, but they were fussing over me as if I were a small child, paying me far too much attention. I couldn't wait to get home and feel grown up again. I wondered if I was destined to go to dinner with old people for the rest of my life. On Thursday, Trish and I went to see Robert Mitchum in Ryan's Daughter. It was rather too long, and neither of us enjoyed it much. Trish was off to London the next day for the second weekend in a row. She'd been dismayed by the high rents charged in the capital.
"Even a bedsit with a shared kitchen and bathroom can be as much as £15 a week," she told me.
"This time I shall search further afield."
We were in a pub in Whitechapel drinking shandy. Trish was small, plump and cuddly, with feathery blonde hair and a little snub nose. She looked at me fondly.
"Gosh, Pearl, I'll miss you when I go."
"And I'll miss you," I assured her.
What would I do on Saturday, for instance?
I'd better think of something before Charles and Marian arranged another meal.
Trish said sadly,
"There's a place I would have loved to have gone before I left Liverpool forever, and that's the Cavern. There was a time when we virtually lived there, but we haven't been for ages.
Now there isn't time before the wedding.
"You're not leaving Liverpool forever," I said comfortingly. "Any road, it's different sort of music in the cavern. These days it's more heavy metal than rock and roll."
Trish grimaced.
"It frightens me that I'm leaving so much behind. London is so big and impersonal compared to Liverpool."
"You'll soon get used to it."
"That's where I could go on Saturday, the cavern. It was the sort of place where no one would notice if you were by yourself."
On Saturday night at 8:30, I stood outside the Cavern Club in Matthew Street, wearing my black flared trousers and a white polo-necked sweater. I'd never heard of the groups that were playing, Mushroom and Confucius. Now that I was there, I wasn't sure if I could bring myself to go in. A few men had entered by themselves, but not a single woman went in on her own. They all looked much younger than me, still in their teens. I wasn't much good at communicating with strangers. If someone spoke to me, I'd be stuck for words. If no one spoke, the chances were I'd sit there all night without so much as opening my mouth, which didn't exactly appeal. The first time I'd come to the cavern had been with a crowd of girls from school. We were only 14, 4 years before I met Trish. No, I wouldn't go in. I'd go home instead. But I couldn't do that. It wasn't all that long since I'd left. Charles and Marion would be watching television, and I'd told them I was going out with one of the teachers from school. "Hilda Dooley," I'd lied when Marion had asked the teacher's name. "The pictures. I'd go to the pictures. It didn't matter what I saw or if I missed some of the film. It was just somewhere to sit until it was time to go home and say I'd been to the cavern. If necessary, I'd say I was going to the cavern every Saturday for the rest of my life, rather than have my aunt and uncle take me to dinner in order to get their 25-year-old niece out of the house. I turned on my heel and collided with a man in a suede jacket, check shirt and jeans.
"Fancy meeting you here," he said.
"Hello," I stammered. It was Rob Finnegan, Gary's dad. "What are you doing here?"
It was a stupid question. Why else would he have come except to listen to Mushroom and Confucius? "My sister Bess and her boyfriend decided to have a nice in. They're babysitting Gary, so I thought I'd go out for a change. Saturday is the only night I have off from the post office."
He looked affectionately at the grimy, run-down building.
"I haven't been here for years."
"Neither have I.
Are you going in?"
"No," I shook my head, as if going in had been the last thing on my mind. "I've just been to the pictures with a friend and thought I'd walk down Matthew Street on my way to the car park to see what the place looks like."
I hoped he wouldn't ask what picture I'd seen.
"It looks pretty much the same to me."
"And me."
A crowd of boys came down the street kicking a tin can to each other. They went into the club. Rob said,
"They look like kids. All of a sudden I feel desperately old."
There was a short silence. I wondered if it was time I announced I was going home, though felt strangely reluctant. Rob stuffed his hands in his pockets and jiggled back and forth on his heels.
"It's only 8:30. Do you fancy a coffee?"
I was about to refuse, but that would have been another lie, as I really did fancy having a coffee with him. But not because it was him, Rob Finnegan, but because he was another human being and I didn't want to be alone.
"Yes, please," I said stiffly. "I'd love a coffee." "I could never get used to the heat in Uganda," he said. "I would have come back before, but Gary loved it there. We lived in a detached bungalow. There were about 20 altogether, all occupied by Brits. We had a communal pool and a nursery for the kids, so I didn't have to worry about having him looked after when I went to work."
"What made you decide to go there in the first place?" I asked.
"After Jenny died, I felt the need to get away from familiar surroundings, and I thought it might help Gary get over it. He was only 2, but he really missed his mum."
"Trouble is," he said with a shrug, "we're pretty short of relatives. Jenny's folks are dead, and so is my dad. My mother married again, but I've never got on with my stepdad."
"And did Uganda help Gary get over it?"
"Yes, it did. And it helped me too, despite the heat."
I leaned back to allow the waitress to remove my empty mug, which was big enough to hold at least 1/2 pint of coffee. Rob ordered 2 more. The basement cafe was only a few hundred yards away from the cavern. It had the same rough brick walls and musty smell and was called Le Beats, an anagram of Beatles. We'd been there nearly 2 hours.
Rob was easy to talk to. We discussed music and films and shared our memories of the cavern, after which he'd told me about life in Uganda.
"How is Gary settling in at school?" he asked now.
"He's a bit shy," I admitted. It didn't help that he came after the start of the second term, when all the children already knew each other and had made friends. When I ask him if he likes school, he goes very quiet, his eyes clouded with concern.
"Is he being bullied?"
"Not in the classroom. I'm afraid I don't know what goes on in the playground. I'd find out on Monday."
"I hope you don't mind my mentioning this," I said hesitantly, "but would you please ask your sister to leave him outside the school gates? She brings him as far as the classroom, and it makes the other boys think he's a sissy."
"I'll speak to Bess about it," he promised.
"Who picks him up after school?" I asked.
"I do, except on the occasions I have a job interview, when the lady next door does it for me."
"It must be difficult fitting everything in," I remarked.
"Extremely difficult," he rolled his eyes. "I don't suppose Gary's much good at games."
"Not really.
Even when he was tiny, Jenny used to say he had two left feet. He was always tripping over himself." He smiled wryly.
"I don't like to boast, but I was a star at games at school. In Uganda, I captained the police football team. The Brits had a league and our team was always top."
"Thank you," he said when the waitress brought our drinks.
"I won't sleep tonight," I murmured. "All this coffee."
Rob put sugar in his and stirred it.
"Do you like being a teacher?" he asked.
"I love it," I said fervently.
"I love children, but..." I paused.
"But what?"
"I don't really know. I think I should be doing more, like teaching in a third world country."
I was putting vague thoughts I'd recently had into words. In some places, education was in short supply and considered very precious. Would I feel happier if I was teaching deprived children in makeshift classrooms or even outdoors?
"There's a guy I knew in Uganda who's trying to fix me up with a job in Canada," Rob said.
"Mind you, I wouldn't mind going back to Africa, despite the heat. The pay's much better, and you don't have to worry about accommodation."
"That's probably a hard-nosed way of looking at it, but my main concern in life is making sure Gary's happy."
"Me, I'll think about it," I said. That night, I dreamt about my father. It often happened, but I could never remember what he looked like when I woke up. I could recall parts of the dream, but not his face. He always seemed to be turned away, standing behind me, or in another room. His voice was muffled and slow. The dream took place in the bungalow by Sefton Park, where we were living when my father had his accident. It had been late afternoon, and must have been winter, as it was dark outside, yet it wasn't time for bed. I was lying on my stomach on the living room floor in front of the coal fire, and drawing a face with a black crayon on a large pad. In the kitchen, my mother and father were arguing, shouting at each other. None of it made sense. It was something to do with the roof. Someone was stealing the tiles. Mum wanted Dad to tie them down.
"You don't tie down tiles, Amy."
"I'll buy some ribbon tomorrow. Shall I get pink or blue?" I listened for a few seconds, then returned to my drawing. To my surprise, there was a bloodstain on the pad. It had fallen on the face's mouth. I raised my head to see where it had come from. Nowhere, it seemed. But when I looked back, there was another red stain, bigger than the first, blotting out the face's eyes.
"Would you prefer yellow ribbon?" my mother asked.
"I told you, you can't tie down tiles. They have to be nailed." There was more blood on my pad. I sat back on my heels and watched the red spots fall until the entire page was soaked in blood. I began to scream.
"Is that you, Pearl?"
my father shouted.
"I'm frightened, Dad,"
I screamed. "I'm coming, Scrap." But he didn't come. I could hear him racing around the house, opening doors, shouting my name, but he never came into my room. I became more and more frightened. I realized he couldn't find me because we were in different houses, but that only terrified me more because he sounded so near. There was a hardly discernible crackling in the air that made the hair on my neck stand on end. I shivered. I was still shivering when I woke up and felt unnaturally cold. The dream was perfectly clear and fresh in my mind. I'd forgotten my father had called me Scrap. I wondered why.
Downstairs I heard the sound of water running. Marion or Charles was putting the kettle on for the first cup of tea of the day. I got out of bed, drew back the curtains, and breathed a sigh of relief. It was morning. Weak sunlight shone on the roofs of the houses, and the sky was a watery grey. There was even someone up. The old man, who lived a few houses away, was pottering about in his greenhouse. Marion knew his wife, and she said he couldn't sleep. I threw on my dressing gown and went downstairs. Chapter 6. October 1939. Amy. Barney had been in Surrey for a month when he was allowed 5 days' leave, but most of the time he and Amy hardly left the flat, just sat and talked about what they would do when the war was over. He wanted to do something more exciting than work for his father. He seemed a bit down and confessed he regretted having been in such a hurry to volunteer. "I miss you so much, Amy," he said miserably. Even the fact that he was being sent on an officer training course didn't cheer him. "The uniform's more comfortable than for other ranks, but that's about all," he sighed. He asked if they could visit her mother. They went one night to find Mam over the moon, having discovered she could get a job in a factory for an unbelievable £4.10 a week. "It's working on a big machine called a lathe," she said vaguely. "I'm going for an interview next week. It's in some place not far from the Philharmonic Hall." Jackie and Biddy stopped staring adoringly at their brother-in-law for a minute to announce their intention of joining the Women's Air Force. But Amy told the pair of them not to be so daft. "You're much too young," she said. Amy had already been to see Charlie and Marion's new house in Aintree, with its modern kitchen and lovely big rooms. She described it to Barney, and they began to design their own house, the one they would live in when their lives returned to normal, actually drawing it on paper and making a list of the colours for each room. They discussed what sort of furniture they would buy and the flowers they would plant in the garden. Now they were applying the finishing touches, choosing the ornaments, the crockery, the cutlery, the front door. "I'd like one with a stained glass window," Amy mused. "Then stained glass window you shall have," Barney said generously. "Two, if you prefer." "One will do, and I'd want it varnished, not painted. The door, that is, not the window." "Your wish is my command, madam." "And where will it be, this house of ours?" he asked.
"Anywhere," Amy said simply. "Anywhere in the world, as long as I'm with you, I don't care." As before, Barney left in the middle of the night without saying goodbye. This time Amy only pretended to be asleep. After the door had closed, she got up and knelt on the floor by the window in the lounge, where they watched the sunset, and rested her arms on the sill. She barely heard him go down the stairs. Then, in the moonlight, she saw his tall, lonely figure pass like a ghost along the road until it was swallowed up in the black shadows of the house next door. Not long afterwards, she heard a car start. Had he ordered a taxi, she wondered, or arranged for Harry to pick him up? What did it matter? What did anything matter now that he had gone? Amy had been buying the Liverpool Echo for weeks to see what jobs were available when she realised she might be pregnant. She'd missed a period, which happened sometimes, but now the next one was late. She sat down with a calendar on her knee and counted the days. It was 9 weeks and a day since her last period. How did she feel about having a baby? Pleased. Really pleased. She looked at herself in the long mirror on the wardrobe. Her stomach looked as flat as a pancake, but she was unlikely to show when she was barely a couple of months gone. "I'll write to Barney and let him know," she said aloud. She fetched the writing pad, but changed her mind before the letter was even started. She wouldn't tell him until it had been confirmed. Women in Mam's part of Bootle consulted Mrs. O'Dwyer, who lived in Coral Street, about their personal problems. But Amy reckoned Barney would sooner she saw a proper doctor. He'd actually mentioned a doctor once. He was a family friend, but she couldn't remember his name. She put the pad to one side and went to kneel by the window, something she'd been doing a lot since Barney had gone away for the second time. She didn't want to miss seeing him if he paid a surprise visit home. Had she got the nerve to go and see Mrs. Patterson to ask the name of the family doctor? The woman was her mother-in-law, after all.
Her son was the father of the baby Amy was almost certainly carrying. He or she would be her first grandchild. Surely she wouldn't turn her away. There was a good chance that Barney had exaggerated about his mother. She understood her not liking Catholics. A lot of people Amy knew couldn't stand Protestants. But surely that sort of prejudice didn't apply to your own flesh and blood, to your grandchildren.
"I won't go today," Amy said aloud. "I'll give it 6 more days, when I'll be 10 weeks late. And I'll go then."
She'd also wait to tell her own mam until she knew for certain that she was pregnant. Mam would be desperately excited, and Amy didn't want her disappointed if it weren't true. 6 days later, she lay in the bath and drew circles on her stomach with her finger. It didn't look quite so flat today. There was a slight bulge in the middle, and she imagined a tiny, perfect baby curled up inside. It might even have its tiny hands pressed together and be using them as a pillow, or be sucking its thumb. "Hello, baby," she whispered. She imagined her baby smiling back and whispering, "Hello, Mummy."